Congratulations! You're listening to Congratulations Pine Tree, the Bay's number one arts and culture podcast with me, Kay Rhodes.
And me, Maysoon Wazwaz.
We're out here at beautiful Minnesota Street Projects, aka MSP, aka Microsoft Paint, talking to artist Dana Hemingway.
Hi.
Okay, now did you grow up in Petaluma?
I did.
Okay, now what is that like?
How many cows did you have?
Were you a cow person?
Sadly, we did not have any cows, but there were some deer that lived nearby that would try to eat our foliage in our yard. No cows or chickens.
Would you consider it a cow area?
Absolutely. It's a cow town, but it's also really big with chickens, and they would have the Butter and Eggs Day parade growing up. Yeah.
Wait, can you tell us a little bit more about the Butter and Eggs Day parade? I've never heard of that, and it sounds amazing. Can we bring it to San Francisco? What do you think?
I don't know if it would work in San Francisco, but it was really sweet. It was just like a parade. It was like Carnival, but just for butter and eggs.
What is Petaluma's relationship to the inner Bay Area? Like, did you come to San Francisco a lot when you were growing up?
Or? Yeah, my mom worked in San Francisco. She did like a psychiatry training at UCSF. So in high school, I spent a lot of time like going with her to work sometimes if I didn't have school, walking around different neighborhoods, mainly Haight Street, that kind of stuff.
And what do you think of it?
I thought it was really cool.
Is your mom currently a psychiatrist?
She's retired.
But she was a psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Seems kind of intense.
It was very intense. There was a lot of discussions about like emotions and, you know, if I got mad, she'd be like, this is just an emotion. It comes in waves and will pass in 3 to 5 minutes. Things like that. Whoa. Which made it very hard to kind of engage in arguments in the normal way.
She's like, I won't have it. This will pass in 3 to 5 minutes. And we're timing now.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you went to UC Santa Cruz for undergrad. Yeah. Were you an art major then?
Yes.
When did you decide to be an artist and how and why?
I always knew I wanted to do something with art from a really young age, and I didn't really know exactly what that looked like. So sometimes it was like, oh, I'll be a fashion designer, an architect, an artist. I didn't really know what the options were, what a contemporary artist was or looked like, really. And then maybe in middle school and high school, started taking more art classes that gave me glimpses into that world, and then knew I kind of around that time that I wanted to study art. And I do remember having some interesting conversations with family about that and was very persistent.
They were trying to discourage you?
Yeah, or just be concerned. Just concerned.
Like, what's your plan B?
Yeah.
They're like, how are you going to make a living?
Yeah.
Wild. Did they all want you to be a psychiatrist?
No. I don't even know if
Maybe
they
like
knew.
An engineer?
Some kind of designer, something that had like a practical, you know, application, not like this crazy thing we do.
And were you always like, you all can go fuck right off?
Kind of. Because I had a little like, you know, alternative punk streak. So I was like, no, I'm doing what I want. I'm going to UC Santa Cruz to study art.
Hell yeah. And then how punk were you? General, how many patches?
not that kind. But I did, okay, like for patches? Example, I feel like we're going so deep in the Genesis and
I
childhood. But like growing up in a very small town where there was not a lot of like, I don't know, interesting things going on. And then I remember in middle school going to like the local pet store to buy like studded collars for the pets, or like little like rhinestone like studded, and then I would wear those as part of my outfits.
Would you think that, Maysoon? Did you know that before right now?
About Dana? No, I wouldn't have known that off the bat.
I'll try to show you a photo later.
Did you have like spiky hair?
I had a shaved head.
Oh yeah.
Nice. And then I had like dyed hair of every color.
Yes.
Yeah. So like purple, blue. I didn't really go for like red or orange. They didn't have as good oranges at the time as they do now, I feel like.
Were you a good student in high school?
I was okay. Yeah, I was pretty good. I was like good enough. I didn't really apply myself as much as I could have until like maybe my senior year. which but was when it didn't count for college anymore. But I, yeah, good enough to.
For I mean, you see Santa Cruz is a good school. Okay, and then you went to Mills for grad school, and you've been in the inner Bay Area ever since. Would that be a true fact?
Yeah, I moved to Australia for 3 months after Santa Cruz. Yeah, and then I moved to San Francisco right after that and have lived in San Francisco ever since.
Do you have any spicy stories from Australia?
Not very spicy, but it was really fun.
Savory? Savory, sweet, sweet. Umami.
Hitchhiking around Tasmania, like around Christmas time, because we went for a friend's like Christmas celebration in what summer there. So eating strawberries at Christmas, having it be really hot, and then like hitchhiking in the wilderness when everyone was not around, and then getting lost and just like walking forever because there was no one there because they were all like with their families at home.
Were you scared to die?
Yeah. And then there was like Tasmanian devils making these insane sounds, screeching sounds.
Oh my God.
That was really scary.
And then you've been back in San Francisco since?
Since 2004.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I thought.
January of 2004. That's when I moved here officially.
Did you ever consider going somewhere else?
Yeah, when I applied to grad schools. I applied to a couple on the East Coast, and I got into some, but the financial aid wasn't as good as Mills.
So you moved here for grad school, or were you here before
I was
you applied?
Here. I was here. I lived here for 4 years before grad school. Applied. Okay. And so I could have, that was kind of a point, like a crossroads where I could have moved.
Do you want to weigh in on any of the very myriad issues of the Bay Area?
I guess, yeah. I mean, I'm really worried about San Francisco, and I'm really like afraid that we will hit like some turning point where something won't be able to change and we'll just lose like all the culture and good people who live here, and arts and just basically anything that's not like a monoculture of tech industry folks. So I really worry about that. But I guess a lot of cities have had a lot of ups and downs over time if you look at like the long view of it. So maybe this is just one little blip.
Oftentimes we talk about, you know, I guess advice for listeners, maybe some people are thinking of going to grad school or not. And I wanted to ask you sort of like some of your decision process around deciding to go to grad school. And if you, like in hindsight also, if you thought it was a good idea and what advice you might, like a piece of advice you'd give to someone today.
Yeah. Well, I think at the time, I was working at the San Francisco Arts Commission Gallery as the gallery manager, and I had kind of worked my way up from an intern to that position. So I had a lot of really amazing experiences with local artists and talked to a lot of people who had gotten their MFAs or some who were still students because they had a student MFA exhibition there at the time. They had the Murphy and Cadogan show there at the time. So I tried to like pick a lot of people's brains through having that position, but even so, I feel like I was pretty inexperienced and didn't really know a lot about kind of the world of academia or MFA programs. And also maybe I feel like it takes going to grad school to know exactly how you would dial in your grad school experience, but then by that point, it's all over.
Yes, that's very accurate.
So I got so much out of Mills and loved the time there and my community there and so many things about that program. But I do feel like, I went to a college thinking I would get a more academic experience that included like a more formal thesis. I don't know why I didn't realize Mills didn't have that. So just kind of where you think you understand a program from like looking at their website 5 million times and then and then what you actually find out about the program when you're in there and you're like, oh, that's different than what I thought. Like, oh, you don't really interact with any of the other departments and they don't encourage you to do things like College Art Association conferences or even kind of engage in that kind of world at all. They're like a little in a different zone. And it was a zone that gave you a lot of space to make work. And that was really generous and special. And I don't know how many times in my life I'd have 2 years to just really make a lot and discuss with people really seriously what I was making. So that was really important, but maybe because of that I lost some of that other side of it that you'd get at a different school. And I didn't really know that going into it. It was a real surprise.
So maybe people should do some research on their programs.
Oh yeah,
I mean, not that you didn't do research, but just sort of like,
no, I was so afraid. I was so like little and scared, and I was like, I don't want to talk to someone real. And that's scary. Yeah. Uh-huh. But now I'm like, to any student in any professional practices class I've taught, or if anyone talks to me that's a student now about going to grad school, I'm like, talk to past students, like sit in on classes. Because I didn't realize till I went to Millis that there would be people who were thinking of applying who would sit in on classes. I was like, what? You can do that? Why didn't I know that?
They'll let you do anything if they think that they can snag you going there.
But I had no idea. And then until I was a first year and there were prospective students sitting in our classes. So doing that, because you get such a better picture of the culture and the dynamic. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's just so many things like that I wish I had done. Reached out to the professors, seen how responsive they were. So you'd know, like, what if a really big name teaches somewhere and they never write you back versus they write you back? Like, that shows you how involved they might be in your actual scholastic career once you go there. So,
what were you making, I guess, when you went into grad school, and how did that shift?
It changed a lot, for sure. But I guess I was like making sculpture, for lack of a better word, but it wasn't super like physical, like three-dimensional large things or anything like that. But I was thinking a lot about mediation and how we understand like things that are no longer around through photographs. So maybe like an event. And so I did a piece on the earthquake actually in my first semester at Mills about the 1906 and 89 earthquake, because we only understand that through very limited documentation of it. And so kind of thinking about the mediation of that event. And then I did a lot of work on like extinct animals, because those were another thing that like we'd have these documents of, but we would not have the real thing left in our world anymore. And so I was really interested in like image making and how images kind of like slice up reality and affect what we know of as, or what we think we know of a situation. Through that, I started making work in like a ceramics class at Mills that was like making the things that like support images, like nails and hooks and photo corners, and like, because I was thinking about the kind of framing devices for these photos and documents that I was really interested in exploring in the work about mediation. And then from that led me to like kind of being more interested in these like kind of utilitarian things that support other things and contribute to like museum displays and kind of mining the museum and institutional critique.
And then you worked for a long time as a preparator.
I did. And that also really informed that work. Mm-hmm. So while I was before grad school, while working at the Arts Commission Gallery, I would work with installers to install the shows. And I learned a lot from those people about installing. I was more in an administrative role, but it was a small staff. So we just did like a lot of things. So I learned a ton about that. And then like the winters and summers, I would work like on call as an installer during grad school. Like at YBCA and the Wattis, and I learned a lot. And through that experience of a lot of technical, practical things, but it became a huge inspiration for my work. I'd find all these like interesting moments, or sometimes you'd see like the underside of a piece, or you'd see the way something was hung or packaged, or the inside of a wall, and finding all this like aesthetic stuff to kind of pull out and talk about and look at.
Did you have a lot of interfacing with artists?
Yeah, sometimes really.
Who was the biggest douchebag?
Oh, God. I wish I could remember so I'd have like a good...
Or the biggest sweetheart.
Well, I worked with Amanda Ross Ho at YBCA for this show that was called Wall Works, which was a very weird show where the first 3 weeks of the show were the last 2-3 weeks of install. So the audience, like it was open to the public so they could see these kind of large... site-based installations, like site-specific installations that were wall-based, kind of unfold. We worked really closely together, and we all had, for some reason, that YBCA would have lunch for everyone, like the installers, the artists, and they'd invite like guest curators and other people and other staff members from YBCA to come. So it was like a very social experience where you really got to know everyone because you're all having lunch together. Working with Amanda Russo, it was really amazing. She was really sweet, and she was super down to earth and incredibly kind.
No douchebags that you care
there,
to speak
there
of.
There might be. Okay, I'm going to.
No, you really don't have to, Dana.
But
this
sometimes,
is a trap.
Okay.
No, it's okay.
Oh, here's another one. This isn't really douchebag, but like Kara Walker made like a piece at the Wattis. She just like had to maintain her own world. is that's what I would say I noticed. Because everyone's like, Kara Walker's here, Kara Walker's here, Kara's doing her installation today, you know? And like, how do you kind of like exist in that space where people like know who you are and there's a little buzz in the air, but then do the work that you have to do? And she would like have her headphones on and like have her agenda, and only like one person kind of really worked with her. Mm-hmm. So she wasn't getting bombarded by a lot of like stuff, you know, things that she didn't need to think about while she was making her installation. So that was really interesting to see. And I wouldn't call it asshole, but I just say like focused and maybe slightly aloof in necessity to that end. Right. Yeah.
How are you like in these situations now that you're an international superstar?
Hardly.
Totally.
I just try to be really respectful of what people are doing and really like acknowledge that I see what they're doing, because I know how much hard work it is, and try to show respect I have for it and also the like joy I have for it. And so there'll be a lot of conversations. We'll be like, oh, what kind of tool are you using? Or like, how are you doing that? Or like, oh, I see you did this. That's really great.
You also were a studio assistant to MacArthur fellow Camille Utterback.
True.
Was she a very sweet person to work for?
Oh, yeah. She was the opposite of diva. And I really felt like I feel like she's a real mentor for me. And especially now that I'm doing a public art piece, and she does so much public art, and I worked with her really closely on some public art pieces. So I really learned a lot from her, and just also had a lot of fun with her. And we both had, I think, the same goofy inquisitiveness about things, and would spend lunch being like, I wonder why this thing in the world is the way it is.
Do you feel like working with her helped your career, or like, I guess, you know, either your career path or even just like how you were thinking about your own work? Like, how did that relationship?
Yeah, work? I feel like our work is pretty different, like in terms of the circles it goes in a way that was, I think, allowed us to work together for so long, because it never felt like, oh, I'm spending this creative part of my brain in this other person's studio, and then that is spent when I get to my studio. It really felt like different parts of me. So it felt really healthy in that way. So I think sometimes, maybe as a result of that, the media art world is so specific that the kind of curators and people she knew are really based in that area. Mm-hmm. So it didn't trickle down in that, like, sometimes really direct way that happens with studio assistants, where like you become represented by the same gallery that the person you work for shows with, or something like that. I don't know what happens. But I think in terms of like how to be an artist in the world and how to like negotiate these big projects or opportunities, and like watching her go through that and do so with so much like grace and sweetness, I think I learned a lot from that and how I would want to be. Yeah. And then she's also spent a lot of time like anytime there's been something big, I'll be like, will you come to my studio and give me advice? And she'll like give me critique and really help push ideas to the next phase. So a lot of mentorship in that area as well, that I think has helped make me a better artist. And it also made me realize like how much really liking the person you work for like is matters almost more sometimes than even just the like nuts and bolts of what you do at a place, in terms of like being happy. Because you see them like more than maybe you even see your significant other or like most of your friends.
So you are represented by Eleanor Harwood.
Yes.
What's that like? How's that happen?
It's
Did
really
you
great.
Set out and you were like, time for me to get representation now?
No, I didn't think that I would ever be represented by a commercial gallery or really have a presence in the commercial gallery world. Even like in grad school at Mills, people would tell me like that don't, you know, like they were kind of confused about how I would fit into that space. I had a piece up at a show at Root Division in 2013. And Eleanor saw it and she emailed me and expressed interest in my work and that piece. And then that just kind of like went on for a while.
In a group show?
Mm-hmm. One piece in a group show.
People.
Take
Kate's,
note.
Kate's mouth is wide open in shock and awe.
Dream big, people.
Yeah. And she was like, I love your work. I'm looking at this piece right now. I'm at Root Division. She's like writing the email in front of the piece is the way it sounded. Yeah. Cute. But yeah. And then we just kind of kept in touch for a while. Like that was a couple years before I started working with her. So it also takes a while, I would say, for any of these relationships to form.
Did you have any misgivings about becoming part of a gallery?
Oh gosh. I mean, yeah. Cause I'm not... My desire for approaching art and being an artist is not through a commercial lens, but of course we all need to survive. And so in some ways it's actually been a release from those things because she deals with all of that. And she's the one that's working with clients if anyone expresses interest, whereas I was always kind of like awkwardly kind of like bumbling through those experiences if they ever happened before. So in some ways it's, I can think about it less in the kind of nuts and bolts like side of things, but I do worry about how much it like kind of can be present in your brain. Like, do you think about things differently or make different work even on like a subconscious level because you're concerned that it be sellable, whatever that is. Mm-hmm. So I definitely have some things to negotiate within that kind of frame of the commercial gallery world. Mm-hmm. But I think living in the Bay Area where the people who are buying art are like genuinely really interested in it for the most part, and it's a pretty small community, I think does make it feel better. It's not, it doesn't, I don't know. Do you know what I mean?
Like there's not a lot of speculators that are just trying to like ride your coattails and auction your shit later and make a ton of money.
Yes.
But do you know of any douchebags who've bought your work?
Not that I know of. And in fact, a lot of artists have bought my work, which makes me feel like really
Yeah, that's honored. Always nice. That's
awesome. Yeah. So anytime I'm like, what? That's so cool. Damn. Yeah, Yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit about your work that you make now for the listener?
Yeah. And I should say that the work I'll talk about is the show that I have up right now at Eleanor Highwood Gallery.
Go to it. So go there today.
Yeah. If you're listening, right when this comes out, go. Please.
Immediately.
So the show is the second solo show I had with Eleanor. And it's... I've been using extension cords a lot in my work for the last couple of years, 5 or 6 years, and using them in really different ways, but to kind of different kinds of craft applications like macrame or weaving, and in combination with other craft forms like ceramics. And for this show, there's a little bit of like the ceramics and extension cord weaving, but for the most part, I started getting really interested in, in all of these pieces, the extension cords power lights. So a lot of the work also became about thinking about lighting and interior design and the relationship between, are these sculptures or are these lamps, are they functional, are they not functional? And so I started getting really interested in the lights as utilitarian objects and how the kind of these functional lights that are really kind of boring and might light up like your garage or like a kind of space that just needs to be well lit. And using them in the pieces and kind of weaving them through ceramic substrates that have a lot of texture and kind of color so that the light like catches it really well. And I also got really interested in rugs this year and started to like research artists that use rugs in their work or rug processes. And so one was this Eva Hess piece where it's called a session. It's like this cube and there's all these tubes that are kind of pushed through this plexiglass walls like a hook rug. So I got really inspired by that piece and thinking about kind of the lineage of the artists who are making that, what they were inspired by. And so I made some rug pieces, one that was made out of traditional fibers like yarn, wool yarn, and then also like tulle, which is like that kind of gauzy fabric that you'd use in like a tutu, and cutting that into little squares and making it into little fiber pieces to add to the rug. And then an extension cord is woven through that. Mm-hmm. And I made that most halfway while at Acre with Kate, so she saw me making it and helped me make some of the squares.
Like five of them.
No, you did a lot, Kate.
Awesome.
You would crank out like a million of those a minute, and it took me like 5 minutes to make one.
Well, the first one, but then you got faster. And you got other people like on board. Like they were like, oh.
She recruited for you?
Yeah, Kate's doing it.
That was my anxiety treatment for that whole time, so I really thank you.
And then, so I used that rug as kind of a platform for a collaboration with a dancer and a choreographer. And so the dancer, Arletta, rehearsed with a rehearsal rug that was a mock-up of the real rug, and then with the real rug just a few days before the opening, and then performed with it at the opening. Mm-hmm. That was really exciting too, because that's something I've also been doing more and more in my practice, is finding opportunities to collaborate with folks in other disciplines like music, writing, sound, dance. Yeah, she did like a 10-minute performance at the opening and just totally changed the way I saw that object. We discussed and decided a few parameters, like no one would ever step on the rug, we decided. Mm-hmm. Partly because of a practical thing, because it just wasn't like strong enough to handle that. But then that became a really important conceptual element of the piece too. And so she was like crawling, like she was like sliding underneath it or wrapping her body around certain parts of it and wearing it like a cape or folding it up with the lights that were part of it inside so that it like glowed out the tulle. And
the music that was used for that performance was incredible. I love that it sort of had like the sound of like electricity or like, you know, sometimes yeah. when you can hear the electrical lines outside, they're kind of like buzzing and snapping
yeah.
and
yeah. So that sound was all recorded from the lights in the show.
Oh,
yeah, from the EMF frequencies yeah. of the lights. So it is definitely electric sounds of electricity, and then they were processed and also used to like make other to kind of put into a computer program to generate other sounds, like some of the kind of like high dinging sounds and things like that. Mm-hmm. And then there was some blue tape being pulled off of. Yeah. Roll. So we wanted something that was like more textural and like physical, like the other parts of the pieces that aren't electrical. And that was made by Matt Robideau, who's my partner. So it's fun. It's an interesting, that could be a good like advice question. What's it like to collaborate with a partner?
Good question for yourself. Go for it.
We love collaboration questions.
Yeah.
So far, it's been really fun.
Because didn't he also do a performance?
He did.
A live performance, yeah.
He did a live performance.
With his like group.
With two other collaborators, colleagues of his from Mills, because he did the music program there. So far, in the way that we've collaborated and kind of the way I've collaborated with a lot of the folks I've been doing so lately, like non-visual artists, is to really give each of us autonomy within the collaboration and trust. There's a lot of dialogue and conversation about the content and, you know, if there's needs that need to be met, logistical or otherwise. But then beyond that, it's really just about that person bringing their vision onto the project and getting to have that autonomy and kind of ownership over what they're doing.
I'm curious about how you choose your materials. Like, what's their relationship to one another?
I've always been really excited about process, and I liked using ceramics in grad school, but post grad school didn't really have access to a kiln, so for a few years I didn't really think about it, and then it kind of started being something I missed, I guess. And then when I did a residency at the Bemis in 2015. So while I was there, they had a kiln. And so I was able to like think about how I would work with the extension cords that I'd been working with for a while with ceramics. And I don't know why I thought of this, but I think I just was excited to have a process. I wanted to do something that felt related to crafts or like textiles, but used ceramics. And so then it was like, ceramics are like a rigid thing. You wouldn't imagine something else being able to move through. And cords are not often used in that way. So kind of this, there's like some weirdness involved in putting them together. And then the materials were so different. Like the ceramics is so fragile, but and like handmade. And then the cord is so like plastic and perfect and manufactured mm-hmm. and flexible. So mm-hmm. I liked the kind of visual tensions and formal stories that were at play there.
Yes.
And it's fun to make.
I also, when I'm looking at your work, I also think about your history as a preparator and mm-hmm. like, especially like the things where you're like manipulating walls and,
yeah.
and that is kind of thought of as like masculine work.
Oh yeah. There's a lot of like gender stuff. In there.
Yeah, exactly. And then yeah. you have the weaving and like all these craft practices that are like feminine and then.
Yeah. And I would say too, I guess the other reason why I got interested in using the ceramics, because that is seen as this craft thing that maybe is something we look at more, like we like appreciate a craft object or we appreciate an art object, but we like tend to ignore or try to like edit out things like cords in our environment. We're like, oh, that's an eyesore, yeah. mm-hmm. you know, or like, yeah, like a bare bulb or like a, yeah. you know, if there's not like a perfect way it's kind of treated, it's thought of as like unappealing. Mm-hmm. So I liked this idea that I could use a craft process or material to kind of make us see this thing we never see, and then do that in a contemporary art space that already often has like a kind of complicated relationship to craft. So in terms of like the content that relates to gender or masculine thing, like stereotypically masculine or feminine things, I definitely am thinking about that, and it's been less binary than that, mm-hmm. I guess. Even when I was first doing these like extension cord macrame pieces, like someone was like, these are very like speak to the domestic to me. And I was like, oh, I never thought about that. Like I never thought about them being about domestic spaces. I always thought about them as in conversation with the gallery space and like extension cords and galleries. Mm-hmm. So that was really fascinating to me. And then it was like, oh, of course I can't not see that now, and definitely need to acknowledge that that's there and a part of the content of the work. So it is there. But I think about it more in relation to like these kind of maybe stereotypes or systems we've put in place around gender that we also don't see that are invisible, and how like these things that are habituated in our built environment that are invisible can become kind of analogous to that thing.
Have you ever thought of showing the work in the dark?
For the sound performance that we did as part of the show up at Eleanor Harwood right now, we turned off all the gallery lights and just had the show lights. And because there's so much fluorescent LED lights in that show, it was actually really bright in there. Yeah. But it was really cool. It had like a really different feel than how the show normally feels. And there's a lot of different color temperatures of the white lights and then some colored lights. Mm-hmm. So it was a really odd kind of interesting vibe in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I tend to not do that because the ceramics part or like the macrame part isn't lit. It's like backlit by the lights. And so you can't see the color in the piece or a lot of detail in the piece if it's in the dark. So there's something like kind of ironic about that too, that they seem super functional. Like you don't need gallery lights for this piece. And it's like, oh, actually
you do. There's other elements then. Yeah.
Yeah. So, interesting. Yeah. That's part of the joke that I feel like I'm making with my work.
Okay. So you also teach, I feel like there was one point where you're teaching in like three different schools at once.
Yes.
Is that the maximum so far?
Yes.
And how'd you do that?
I still don't know how I did it. And I don't think that I was as good of a teacher. Or maybe I was, maybe they didn't notice, but I wasn't doing all of my little like record keeping, you know? Like I wasn't as attentive to emails, especially like sometimes I would often follow up on emails in person instead of like writing back extensively or things like that. So I had to learn how to streamline a lot of things, I guess. And I spent a lot of time in the car and listened to a lot of podcasts, which then all of your conversations with people at openings are about this podcast you were listening to. I think it's okay to do it for a little bit. I don't know if it's good to do it forever, because at least that was what kept me going, was I was like, once this semester's done or this quarter's done, like there'll be a little bit more like balance. And then also just teaching in general, or especially something like that was so extreme, it's so easy to let it fill your entire life and just spend all of your waking hours like writing emails or preparing things or dealing grading, whatever that goes along with teaching. And at a certain point, I realized if I don't, like I would say to myself, well, I'll just focus on this now, and then at the end of the semester, I can hang out with my friends or see my family or be outdoors. And then I was like, wait, that will be my whole life if I, because there's never, like, then you just do it again, you know? And like, so I was like, if I don't make an effort to do those things while the semester is going on, I won't ever do them. And that really changed my quality of life when I made that kind of decision and saw that dynamic.
Back in 2018, KQED was doing this series. I don't know if they're still doing the series called.
They are.
The Hustle. Where they're highlighting, you know, artists throughout the Bay Area and how they make a living and make it work. And I don't know where you were in that series, but I remember distinctly being like, whoa, go Dana. Because it's, you're like, you know, you put out your salary, you put out, like, it was just like hardcore truth. Here it is. It's fucking hard as hell. But I just was like, I feel like I admired you for just being like so upfront about how you make it work. Because in our society, salaries are not spoken. Like all these things are unspoken, but it really doesn't do anyone a favor. Like we all should be just actively talking about this.
Yeah. Well, so I guess because I taught a number of professional practice classes and senior like capstone classes that covered professional practices. So I was working a lot with students who were really mystified about the whole process and scared about what was going to come next, and practiced a lot of like radical transparency with them, and just tried to be as like real and honest as possible about the situation and not sugarcoat things, but also talk about the great things about being an artist. And so I had a seen that that was really something that was needed, and also maybe had gotten some like exposure therapy in doing it in a small, safer setting. So, so when Sarah Hotchkiss was like, I'm doing this series, I'm trying to like find people, like she just said it in passing in a conversation. I was like, I'll do that. I was like, you need someone? I don't know. I don't know why. But I just was like, yeah, I want to talk about that. Like, I think it would be good to be more transparent and have people see at least one story of how someone figures it all out. But it was kind of, I forgot how small the art world was, and was like, oh yeah, every one of my friends and colleagues and contacts will read this and know like exactly how much my house rent is.
Everything about you.
Yeah. And how much I'm driving. And yeah. And I was like, oh no. But it was already out there in the world at that point, and people were really nice about it, so that made it easy. Yeah, but I did get a few like odd comments on Instagram posts.
Oh, really?
That KQED posted. Yeah.
Like what?
Like someone was like, how does someone pay that rent on that salary? Like, she must have a partner that helps her.
Oh, no.
And I was single at the time. And then I like commented, I was like, I don't.
And then did they ask you out?
Then no. Then they were like, oh, okay, cool. Or like whatever. You know, like they like I think felt bad. They like forgot that maybe the person they were talking about could be reading that.
Yeah.
Okay, you also go to every opening that happens.
Hardly.
Is there a space that is the most exciting to you right now? You don't, I mean, obviously you have like a lot of allegiances for various things of like being on the board.
Let me plug. No,
but yeah.
No, I really.
Maybe just like, it doesn't have to be like your favorite, but just like.
Okay, here's a favorite, but it's maybe like a weird favorite. Or I don't know. But I really like Adrian Rosenfeld Gallery. And part of the reason why I like it is because I'm like obsessed with that space. Like the visual, like the gallery part of it. The lighting in there. It's part of Minnesota Street Project. It's next door to Altman Siegel and McAvoy Foundation. So he also gets people into the Bay Area that we don't see very often. Like there's an Arte Povera artist up right now there that's really amazing. Yeah, and then the lab. I guess I would say that's another one that I've been frequenting a lot, and for their music performances and the way that they're kind of like bridging music and art and dance, and for what I've been interested in lately, like researching or like seeing all these things.
You're working on a big public art project with the Arts Commission. Do you want to just say a couple things about that so that people know where to look?
I'll just say that I'm midway through the fabrication for my first ever permanent public art piece. It'll be the largest artwork I've ever made, taking up around a 30-foot by 30-foot by 20-foot space in SFO's Terminal 1. And it will be pre-security, which is nice. So you can go without taking a flight. And it will open sometime in early 2020, they think around February or March, to the public. So please keep an eye out.
Okay, we always like to ask our interviewees at the end of an interview if there's anything else you would like listeners to know.
Gosh, we covered so much. We went so deep into my history.
You don't got a plug or a shout out, or you could make an endorsement, a political endorsement.
The shout out is to all the recent controversies that have happened in the art world lately. The George Washington High School mural. And then
George Washington.
Wait, what about it?
Just the controversy.
Just the controversy. Just the fact that all of a sudden, and not to belittle the controversies that I think are really valid and I have strong opinions about, but also just like watching these things unfold and having them be part of our community and seeing our community members talk about them from a really personal point of view, rather than like it being on the other side of the globe and you're like, oh, what did they do?
Yeah.
I think it's really interesting moment in time that the Bay Area is kind of reckoning with some things. So that's my shout out, is to that process unfolding.
Very conceptual shout out. Okay, Dana, thank you so much for talking to us today and letting us into the Microsoft Paint Citadel. And
it's beautiful
here. As so always, nice. Congratulations. Congratulations.